reach the Outrider Podcast.
All right. Hello and welcome to episode 18 of the Outrider Podcast. I, of course, am Jason Quinn Millott. Thanks for downloading and listening. Let's get right to it today because, well, this almost didn't happen. My guest today is Shandell Beers, and today's episode was actually the second attempt. I'd been having some computer problems and farting around with the thing, and apparently tweaked a setting that I hadn't looked at or bothered with since I first set up the podcast. So, you know, I Skyped in with Shandell and I'd even taken off time early from work to try and get everything set up, and spent an hour farting around with the computer, half of that hour on my own and the other half with Shandell on Skype looking at me as I struggled to get Skype and GarageBand and everything to talk to each other so that we could record our conversation. And no matter what I did, it didn't work. So we rescheduled and logged off of Skype, and 30 seconds later, I had it fixed. So it turns out just some little weird microphone setting in Skype that I had, you know, like I said, not bothered to tinker with since I had first set up the all the programs to work together. So we wait a week. On Friday, we log in again. This time I took a half day off from work so that I would have plenty of time during the afternoon before we talked to each other to get everything squared away. And I got it all fixed, got it all ready to go, got on, and I shot an email to Shandell to let her know that was okay. And then she says, can we do it early? I had forgotten all about, you know, a date she was going to she was going to go on a date with her partner, and had forgotten about it, you know, or at least, you know, I'm just a dude. She didn't have to tell me anything. She said, can we go early? I said, sure. It's a good thing I took the time off. You know, I'm available. If I'd been waiting till 5, we would have missed each other again. So we finally get on Skype, ready to record it, and we don't get audio from her again. And I start to panic. And finally, this time it wasn't my fault. It was sort of something on her end, but she clicked the right button, and suddenly we had audio. We were recording levels. Everything was good. So we had a great conversation. I hope you'll enjoy it. Oh, a real quick note. Shandell, of course, is the author of two poetry collections. The first one was A Brief History of Time, and her most recent one is The Children's War and Other Poems. They're both from Salt Publishing. She's also had poetry and fiction and creative nonfiction published all over the place. You'll find a link to her website in the show notes, so go pay a visit to her there, and you can learn more about her, and go and find her books. She actually reads a poem for us at the end of the podcast, so that's great. You'll get to hear what her work sounds like. So let's get right to it. Here's my conversation with Shandell Beers.
Now?
I can hear you now.
Okay. Can you see me?
Yes!
Okay. Yay! All right.
We've defeated the universe.
Let me log off of Facebook then. Yeah, because I thought Bruce was here today and I hadn't seen him yet. And so I got worried and I thought, okay, maybe I can figure it out in his office. Right. I don't see you on video. Like, I see a picture of you. So I'm trying to figure out. Let's see.
Oh, does that work?
There you are.
There I am.
Okay. That works.
Okay. Why?
Sorry about that.
Thanks for taking the time to reschedule and all that good stuff. I'm glad we got the technology working at last. So, Shandell.
Yes.
Welcome to my virtual studio for the Outrider Podcast.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know if you've ever had a chance to hear any, listen to any of the episodes before. If not, it's not a big deal. I don't do a whole lot of research. Okay. It's just kind of a conversation. I like to talk to writers who I either have known for a number of years or whose work I've read and like and want to get to know. So, and because I'm stuck in a town that kind of has very nascent, cliquish, hidden literary scene. They don't get out and talk to each other much, so.
Right. And you know. I'm trying to remember, it's not Wichita. Where are
yep.
you? Oh, Wichita. You are in Wichita. Which is kind of a big city, though, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
It is.
Sure, I thought it was, you know, because I'm in a town of 16,000 people, so.
So there's, you are the literary community all by yourself, then.
Actually, we have a pretty active one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because we have a college here, you know, mm-hmm. so we have, I would say probably in town, maybe half a dozen writers who've had books published.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a small group, but everyone's mm-hmm. really nice and everyone hangs out together. So.
And you're not far from Portland, are you?
Well, we're on the other side of the state, so it's okay. 3 hours. So some people, you know, go to Portland like once a month for a writer's group. I'm not mm-hmm. in a position where I can drive, you know, like 200 miles once a month for a writer's group. But,
right.
But one of the retired instructors here, I mean, she's very active. And, you know, Ursula K. Le Guin is in her writer's group. Like some.
Wow.
Yeah. Like great Portland writers. And wow. actually, Ursula's daughter used to teach here. So I have her old office.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a, even though it's a small town, it's like a cool writing energy
uh-huh.
place.
Yeah. I'm trying to do something to reinforce that and build that up here, you know, because we've got an MFA program at Wichita State University here.
Right.
But they're woefully underfunded. Okay. And so the instructors act as their own support staff.
Right.
And you know, situations and things the way they are in Wichita, they've, on some days I want to just say, well, they're, you know, they're insular and cranky and they don't like to talk to other people. And on the other hand, I kind of understand it. I mean, they've kind of in a way had themselves beaten down and
right.
they're afraid to do anything in a way, because if they do something without funding, they'll expect, they will be expected to always do it without funding.
Right.
Right. And it's like, I never have funding, so I either do it or it doesn't get done,
right.
and I'm miserable. So I'm trying not to be miserable here. You know, we have little writers groups that do stuff around here, but there is almost a kind of willful, stubborn
mm-hmm.
amateurishness about it.
Right.
It's like we're amateurs and we don't want to know what the professionals know.
Yeah. Well, that's like, kind of the Midwest.
Maybe so.
Those people. I'm from Indiana, so.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you know, did you grow up in Indiana?
Yeah. I'm from like a half hour south of South Bend.
Uh-huh.
I was actually born in South Bend, but I'm from a little town called Argus. I was just born in South Bend because my mom was afraid of like the little, you know, town hospital sort of thing.
Right.
But yeah, I lived there until I was 18. And then I went to college in Alabama just to try something
different. Wow. Right.
Yeah. And so Alabama was where I got the most scholarship money.
Right.
Yeah. But I'm not really a Southern kind of person, I guess.
Right.
You know, like in the Midwest, I guess we're pretty blunt, even though people think we're nice, it's very different than the South. So
it's kind of, I'm on a 2-for-2 streak right now. Yeah. I talked to Laird Hunt, who grew up in Indiana for the last episode. Which is interesting. I seem to be running into Indiana a lot lately. Was it a small farming type of community, or was it just a small town?
It was pretty much farming. I mean, pre-NAFTA, there were big factories, you know, like that
right. made
GM parts, basically. But post-NAFTA, you know, not so
right.
much. Yeah.
What did your parents do?
Sort of interesting. My dad's like disabled military, and uh-huh. my mom was a newspaper editor for a while and adjunct at college and that
right.
thing.
Huh. Huh. So I guess your dad was Vietnam era then, right?
Yeah. He never went to Vietnam, but he's that age.
Okay. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, my dad never went to Vietnam either. He went through ROTC at Wichita State and then was stationed at Fort Hood and then Fort Benning. And I think because his primary military specialty was medical supply, he never got, and it was towards the back end of the war and, you know, in 70 and 71. So he didn't really, they never sent him. Right. And he says, that's probably a good thing because I probably would have died in the first 30 minutes.
Right. Yeah. You know?
So was, aside from your mother having, you know, the newspaper and the adjuncting thing, did you have, you know, were you always going to be a writer or did you have other plans?
Well, I think most weird kids grow up to be something artistic. So I was probably just a weird kid. Uh-huh. This is how it happened. I mean, I was in college, I was a dance and English double major.
Wow.
And I love dance, but, you know, the average retirement age for a ballerina is like 26 or so. So it's been dead in ballerina years. Not even retired, dead, you know?
Have you read anything or know Emily St. John Mandel?
That name sounds familiar, but I can't think of work right off the top of my head.
She was started off as a dancer, ended up as a writer.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, she's got a new book coming out in September called Station 11.
Oh, wow.
Highly recommend her. She's very good.
Oh, in case cool.
Just a random recommendation.
Yeah, no, that's great.
So what was Alabama like?
Different. I don't want to offend any, you know, listeners that are from the South, but there was a different kind of racism and a different kind of sexism. And, you know, not to say that Indiana is progressive because it's not, but, you know, one of my first friends that I met at college, I said, what are you majoring in? And she said, oh, I'm just here to get my MRS degree. And
right.
It was 1995. And then, you know, people would say things like, I'd want to go to a certain, or we'd want to go shopping. And I'd say, oh, well, why aren't we going to the Walmart next to campus? And they'd say, well, that's the black Walmart. Because
oh my God.
There's still two of everything in Montgomery, Alabama. So it's,
wow.
Even though it's not legally segregated, it's still
right.
Segregated. And I just wasn't expecting that. It was very different. You know, whereas maybe in Indiana, you know, I grew up in a town with maybe two black families in it, if that.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it was more of, if there was racism, maybe it was ignorance. Like nobody had ever met a black person or something.
Right.
Whereas Alabama was just a completely different, you know, very overt sort of racism.
Wow. Wow. Because I've never really been any farther south than, you know, for any length of time, any farther south than Oklahoma.
Right.
Even though I was born in Georgia, but that was while my dad was in the service.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I don't even remember it, really.
Right.
Not at all. I mean, I have pictures, but...
Right, yeah, but as far as the culture, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, just strange. I've been thinking, you know, since you agreed to talk to me, how it was that we got connected. So there's Alabama. You know, did we find each other on Facebook because of the mutual interest in the Balkan War, or was it because of Stephen McClurg?
I think it might have been the Balkan War, because when I was looking at, you know, various wars to write about in my second book, The Children's War, where I look at artwork done by children from various wars, I was doing a lot of research.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that's how we came across each other.
Fascinating. I was just curious, because there's been a number of writers that I'm connected to on Facebook, people that I've become, you know, friends with in some fashion. It's like, I cannot, since we never met in person, I cannot remember how the connection
right.
was made.
Well, and the beauty of Facebook is they'll say, you're friends with so-and-so, and they're friends with so-and-so. Would you like to meet this person? You know, and
yes, I
you
would.
Just click, yeah.
I've started a kind of my own little mental game. I call it the 6 degrees of Ezra Pound.
Right.
After the Kevin Bacon thing, but it's all literary. How many steps back before you're connected to Ezra Pound?
Right.
I don't know how to really win that game or even really play it. It's a joke, basically.
It sounds good.
Where did you go after Alabama?
After Alabama, I went to the University of Chicago.
After going to the Deep South, you just had to go way north.
Yeah, I had to get closer to home. The University of Chicago was great. I did a master's that was a split between British literature and philosophy.
Wow.
And I wasn't sure if I was ready for a PhD, because the University of Chicago is crazy. It's just so high pressure. So I just sort of adjuncted for a while, and then I decided on an MFA because I could do that low residency while I was, working a bunch of jobs as an adjunct.
Right.
So I ended up getting a job with, an MA and an MFA, wow. And, not really needing a PhD. Mm-hmm. And right. then, magically fell into the 2-book deal. So, I don't know how as a poet I did that, but I'm very thankful. I just sort of didn't need the PhD route, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you can still kind of do that with the MFA. You can, despite the rise of the creative PhD program.
Right.
Of course, it helps to have, the 2-book deal or even the 1-book deal real close after you finish the MFA. It took me 7 years.
Right.
After the MFA, and there was no way I could have survived and paid student loans adjuncting.
Oh.
So I got kicked out of the academic track real quick.
Right. Oh, I'm paying student loans until I'm 55. So, yeah.
I'm thinking mine's going to go longer. I had to put mine in forbearance so many times, but
it's painful to think about. Yeah. Cause I have
really is.
3-year-old. Right. And when he goes to college, I think I'll still be paying student loans for like 3 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Makes you really hope that they can get some of those bills out of committee for, relieving student loan debt and doing all of this like that. Cause I'm sure it's this way for just about everybody who's in any profession, but I think that the student loan thing is really slaughtering our creative future.
Oh, yeah.
Because, the hardest it is, I'm sure it's hard teaching and writing and balancing that with family and everything else. But, wow.
Yeah.
How do you, I find it hard just taking care of myself, working full time and trying to write with everything else I'm doing.
Right. I mean, luckily, my partner Jared is an artist also. So he understands, he's sort of like super guitarist where he's, in a band, he does guitar repair at a music store. He teaches guitar lessons. So, but he's also, a stay-at-home parent when he's not doing those other jobs. So that really helps a right. lot.
Cool. Where did you do the low residency and what was that like? Cause I did the whole full thing, hang out and.
I went to Vermont College. Okay. It's now Vermont College of Fine Arts, in Montpelier. And it was just amazing because I feel like it's really more how writers work. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like any of us have our editor at home with us, or I guess maybe some people do, you're in that marriage, but, you send in packets or else you email packets and your advisor would, send comments back, or some advisors did even like letters on tape, where they would say, oh, I'm going to read this part of your poem back to you with my suggestions. Wow. And yeah, to me, it was just a really great way to work.
Huh. Who were some of your instructors, either Alabama, Chicago, Vermont, that had an impact? Who were you drawing from?
In Vermont, I really worked with, I'm just thinking, my four advisors were Natasha Salyer, Claire Rossini, Richard Jackson, and Leslie Allman. And okay. I think I learned a lot from all of them. Mm-hmm. I think Richard Jackson probably helped the most with getting other things into my poetry. You know, he'd say, well, you took all this philosophy in graduate school. Where are the philosophers? Or you like mountains. Where are the mountains in your poems?
Right.
And, you know, it helps me really get more of myself into the work.
Absolutely. Huh. Well, I guess along the same vine thing is, I always like to say that, you know, unlike our families, writing, you get to choose your lineage, who it is that you... I mean, that's an important thing. So who are your poets or your writers or your artists that you feed off of, that you hope to be descended from?
Right. Well, some of them go way back because mm-hmm. my, you know, British literature background, like I originally wanted to be a Milton scholar.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I don't know if this is right to say, but I sort of read a lot of Stanley Fish, and that kind of, like, he felt like, or as like an 18 to 20 year old reading his work, it felt like, oh, he knows Milton, and who am I to say, right. You know? so I ended up with different specializations, but I really mm-hmm. love Milton, the Romantic era poets, especially mm-hmm. Keats, definitely Blake. Like, if anyone could be as weird as William right. Blake, that would be great. and then, you know, for more modern writers, you know, Anne Sexton, Eve Anne Boland. Mm-hmm. I actually met Eve Anne Boland when I was in undergrad, and Joy Harjo also. And so just to actually like meet real women poets, you know, mm-hmm. was amazing. And then as far as, you know, who I worked with in graduate school, I love all of, you know, my advisor's work, but Richard Jackson with those big, long associative poems mm-hmm. where, you know, everything is in there from, you know, like you said, the Balkans to, the Spin Doctors and, you know, just, you know, amazing leaps of,
right.
of subject.
Wow. Yeah. When was the first time you actually met a working writer? Do you remember?
I would say probably Joy Harjo when I was in undergrad. She came and spoke right. to our class. And it was really cool. Like, she was doing a book signing, you know, after uh-huh. She gave a reading. And she said, "Are you a writer? You look like a writer." And I hope she doesn't say this to everyone or else, you know, my whole life has been based on a lie. But she drew all these little stars in the book uh-huh. where she signed it, and it was just such a beautiful thing.
Right.
Yeah. And then, you know, maybe 2 years later, I met Eve Anne Boland, and she's the one who said, "Oh, I think University of Chicago would be good for you." Mm-hmm. And so that was amazing, you know, to have someone think I could go to an Ivy League ranked school and,
right.
you know, sort of push me in that direction.
Before the incident with Joy Harjo, had you thought seriously about, you know, making a life as a poet or as a writer?
I don't know. I mean, you know, like I wrote, and I guess I, you know, I'd been published like in my college literary journal, but
right.
you know, sort of probably thought I would, you know, teach high school English and, uh-huh. you know, like in a little farm town somewhere or something.
Right.
Yeah. And so I guess it was more, you know, like my junior, senior year of college where my professor said, you know, you could go to grad school and you could, you know, be a professor. And it's still one of those things of, you know, well, I am, you know, I've been a professor for like 14 years now, but I also started out $120,000 in student loan debt.
Right.
You know, that
right,
kind right. of thing. So on the one hand, it's a great life, but I don't know if it's that much different than, you know, teaching high school and.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I had no real idea that you could make a life for yourself as a writer, right. And you know, without being like a Stephen King type of thing, you know. I guess there, you know, I'd been in bookstores, I'd seen all those books, and I guess I'd never really, when I was young, especially, I'd never made this connection that, you know, that most writers did other things and still did this literary thing.
Right.
And I didn't meet my first, you know, published writer until I got to college and realized that, oh, there's a way to do this, to have right. this thing that I want to do. And at the time I thought not be a corporate slug. And yeah. What am I doing with my days now? I'm a corporate slug, but I have a novel, damn it.
You know? Right. In a way, you know, like most writers are probably English professors, I'm guessing, you know, but you're not grading all of that work, you know, and there's wonderful student work. Don't get me wrong. You know, we just gave our creative writing awards today and had our students, you know, read and had a little, you know, punch and cookie reception. And their work was so good. But a lot of the work that you read, you know, it's like, it's not even in sentences, you know, like, and sometimes right. I'm like, why am I teaching how to write sentences to college students? Yeah.
Yeah. I had that experience. I did adjunct teaching Comp 1 for about 5 years. And man, just teaching Comp 1 to these kids, and I was sorely disappointed.
Right.
And realized that even though I disliked my high school and thought it was a backwards, hick, you know, hillbilly type of high school.
Right.
Somewhere out of there, I learned something.
Yeah.
That these kids apparently weren't getting.
Right. Well, and I think, I mean, not to get too political, which, yeah, like I've ever been shy about that. But I really feel like No Child Left Behind and standardized testing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because we shouldn't have to teach college students that a sentence in English, you know, the easiest way to do it is subject, verb, object, you know?
Right.
So I think I've seen that change recently. You know, I do think it's a recent thing that, oh, you can get to college and not know how to write sentences.
Yeah, I got to a point where I said, where I would get these students and I would get them, you know, to get that, you know, simple.
You
know, subject, verb, object. Just get it real simple. And they would still be trying to write these compound, complex, you know, things, try and sound smart. I said, listen, all you're doing, this complex hoo-ha you got here, makes you sound stupid. And if that's what you're worried about is sounding stupid, you've succeeded. So break it down. One thought, one sentence.
Right.
And once you master that, then you can master the comma.
Right. Well, I mean, Hemingway did fine with subject, verb, object.
Yeah.
You know, he went to the river. The river was there. I mean, he was okay with that.
Yeah. My favorite students, though, were always the non-traditional ones because they had a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they read the syllabus.
Right.
And, you know, if I said, you know, call me and make arrangements to hand in your paper because I don't accept late papers, they would do that. I didn't get excuses from them.
Right.
You know, oh, love the non-traditional students, the grown-ups. The kids just out of high school were horrid. There were a couple of good ones, mind you. You know, kids who had their heads screwed on straight, their parents were engaged. I got along with those. No. Oh. I was so desperate to stay in the academic world just in case something came along and opened up. And then I thought, it's not going to happen. I haven't, the timing was always off. So I just gave up on it.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
It's a tough market.
Yeah. Now, did you, You also do prose, but you haven't collected any of that yet, correct?
Right. Press 53 a few years ago published, they have an anthology called Press 53 Spotlight, mm-hmm. where they publish 5 poems each by 5 poets, and then 3 short stories each by 3 short story writers, hence the 5-3. For Press 53. Right. And I was featured in, I think, the 2010 one, mm-hmm. which means they're sort of expecting me to finish a short story collection, but I just need like 3 or 4 more good stories to round it out. but fiction takes me a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you also, if I remember in my perfunctory research, you're working on a novel? Is that right?
I always get stuck. So I
But you've gotten past 100 pages, right?
Oh no. I don't think so. Yeah, I think I get stuck at like 40. Like 40 is where I always get stuck. Because that's where you have to like be a little bit of an egomaniac. And I'm not saying I'm not. I'm sure many people, you know, who I've dated or students or someone will be like, oh, she's an egomaniac. But you have to reach a point where you're like, someone wants to pay attention to me for this long.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's hard. At least like a poetry book. I mean, I have them with me. It's like this thick, you know, like,
yeah. It's pretty easy to pull those off.
Yeah, people can pay attention to anyone for that long. It's just,
relatively speaking, having written poetry, it's not easy writing poetry. That's
but you know what I mean. Like, I have to stack up like 10 of these to be like a huge novel.
So what is it that you think is bogs you down? Is it?
I'm not sure. I don't know if I just yeah. But I know that Sherman Alexie says that's where he gets stuck.
Yeah.
You know, he said there's some sort of place around like chapter 4 or chapter 6 where you're like, mm-hmm. why am I doing this? And is this any good? And maybe I just can't talk myself, you know, down from the ledge or something.
Right. Yeah, that's why my cutoff and some of my instructors, you know, when I went to Naropa, had the same kind of idea about that 100-page cutoff. If you can get past 100 pages, you know you've got yourself a novel going on. And that feels about right to me, because my biggest problem with short fiction was that I always went long.
Okay.
And, you know, 40 pages of a 40-page short story, you know, was that was pretty easy. I could do that and be like, no, that's a novella, a novelette, whatever.
Right.
And there was always so much going on in my stories that it was, that they always seemed to fail because of that. They didn't have that tight, compact, which is odd. The other thing I'm good at is either, if I'm going to go tight and compact, I'm going to write a poem.
Yeah.
But if everything else has to be a novel for me, and I don't know why.
Right. Yeah. Something to think about. Cause yeah, I have short stories where you're like, that's crazy. Someone dies and that's like, that should be a novel. But, yeah, I'll have to think about this. Maybe if I can make it a running metaphor, you know how they say like, oh, you don't have to be able to run 26 miles to run a marathon. You just run 20 and then the last 6 feels like nothing. So if I can get to that point in writing.
Well, one of the things that I learned real quick is it's beginnings are really easy. And Bobby Louise Hawkins used to say this to us. You know, if you have a hard time with middles, but you're really good at beginnings, just string together a whole bunch of beginnings.
Right.
And, you know, eventually you'll have something long enough that you can then thread something through it to make it arc into a story.
Yeah.
Well, and
that makes sense. One of my friends, Pam Steele Reese, she's hyphenated, but she has a novel that's very episodic. And she said, oh, I didn't even know it was really a novel. You know, I was just writing these little glimpses of people's lives and then sat down on the floor with the papers all over and put them in an order. And so that makes it feel manageable, you know, that and what your friend said.
Well, that's how I pulled off the first novel, was just these little tight, compact episodes, and I strung them together, just kind of exploring these characters as they go through their stuff. And then, and I'm trying to do that with the one I'm working on now. But it's some days, I swear to God, I feel like I forgot how to do it, you know? And I think that has to do with time and the fact that the novel that I have out now to agents and editors is pure direct line, one focal point narrative. Just forward, it's there's hardly any flashbacks, any scene jumping, so like that's just straight line.
Yeah.
I guess that's what I needed to amuse myself at that particular moment. Do you find that that's something that you need to do as well, is change up how you do stuff to keep yourself interested, or is it with poetry for you, is it compact enough that the interest is more the image or the idea than how it is that you put it together?
Yeah, I think it's more that, you know, I'll just have an image and I'll say, or I'll, you know, here's some weird science fact. And, you know, so each one of those is the poem. My second book is really the only thing I've ever done where I had like a project or, you know, something where I had an idea of an arc and had multiple poems. Otherwise, I just sort of write poems until I have enough that it feels like a book. And, you know, like, I'm like, oh, that's 50 poems. That's a book.
Have you ever read Michael Ondaatje's book, autobiography of Billy the Kid?
Yes.
Yes, you could string together a novel in poems.
Oh.
I'm just throwing ideas out at you.
You know, I thought about it.
He represents for me that kind of structural linguistic breakthrough that I've been looking for years. I'm fascinated by his work. Who are some of the people that you're particularly fascinated with right now? Who kind of grabs your attention when they come out with a book?
Right. Like fiction or poetry or both, or
all of it, anything? Either one. I'm always looking for good poetry recommendations, just because, you know, poetry sections in even good independent bookstores sometimes can fall into disrepair if there's not like one person there who's particularly obsessed with it.
Right. I really love Mary Bidinger's work. Okay. Yeah, I just read just finished yesterday Saint Monica, where she, you know, takes the patron saint of, you know, alcoholics and abuse victims and sort of makes her like a, you know, modern girl. And that was just so good. And actually, her latest collection, I think, just released today. And I don't know the name of it right offhand, but I saw, you know, on Facebook, she had like a picture of her books and said, they're here. But her work is just so great. And
what was her name again?
Mary Bidinger. I hope I'm saying it right. Bidinger.
Okay.
And her last collection, I think, was Oh Holy Insurgency.
That's a good title.
Yeah. It's just a great collection. And it's one of those where there's enough weird and sort of wacky stuff going on in the poems that I always read each poem twice before I, you know, flip the page.
Right.
Kind of thing. Because I feel like my work is, at least a lot of it, is pretty narrative and straightforward. And
I get that impression.
That's not interesting, but, you know, like...
No, not at... That's... I don't think... I think part of the problem with the getting poetry out in the world is that we think poetry has to be a certain way. And if you can break that down, that poetry can exist in all sorts of different forms and shapes and styles and whatever, then you open up that idea that, no, this is what this is about language, about image, about emotion. It's about sense. When I talked to Ed Skoog, he said that, you know, the whole reason humans came up with language was so that we could make poems.
Right.
That's the only reason. There's no other reason for language except poetry.
Right.
I thought, yeah, that's right, you know. And then, of course, there was somebody on Fresh Air with Terry Gross one time was talking about a book that they had written about poetry where he's, and I can't remember the guy's name, and he had said, those who don't read poetry aren't fit to be let loose in the world. Uh-huh. You know, and T.S. Eliot, who was, I think, was the one that really kind of, at least from the American side, pushed for poetry to be this academic weird thing like that. And I'd like to go back in time and just kind of smack him around. So, yeah. Okay, so we were going on with who else you had.
It's okay. Yeah, I mean, as far as poets, you know, that's the most recent thing I read. But before that, I was reading Hannah Stevenson.
Okay.
Yeah, has this like little slim volume called In the Kettle, The Shriek. And just really fun, witty wordplay kind of stuff. I mean, very intelligent, but just, you know, there's a beautiful lightness to it.
Right.
And then I'm trying to think of other poets. Like, I came home from AWP with, you know, a giant stack of literature. So I've been reading all kinds of stuff, like Kyle Miner's short story collection, Print mm-hmm. Drunk. It's, you know, collected short stories.
Just, yeah, I've got that on my shelf. It's on my to-read list.
It's amazing. It will emotionally destroy you. So read it where you're comfortable crying.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of what else. And then I've been reading some things that I don't know if they would be considered literary fiction. But one of my friends from college sent me When She Woke. And I'm trying to think of who it's by.
Oh, I think I know that.
Yeah, but it's like a rewriting of The Scarlet Letter.
Huh.
Yeah, so it's like The Scarlet Letter, but in futuristic dystopian. So it's like
oh, wow.
Cross between The Scarlet Letter and The Handmaid's Tale. And just crazy, you know.
That's oddly prescient for for right. parts of this country today.
Oh, definitely. But one of my specializations in grad school was like the rewriting of things, like rewriting of myths or Bible stories or Shakespeare.
Right.
Because I just love that idea, you know, of taking something and redoing it. And yeah.
It's immensely fertile ground. It's kind of yeah. It's kind of what Joseph Campbell talked about and how, you know, we're kind of in this time between myths. And there is the tenor of the metaphor that it makes up a mythology is constant mm-hmm. no matter the time period. And so we have these great, great meaningful stories from mythology, from, you know, religions, whatever. And I think we're going to see it a lot more. And I think we probably should see it a lot more is drawing, you know, obviously from those old mythologies and somehow updating them not necessarily because, you know, we've run out of ideas, but because it serves as a bridge to this thing we've always known.
Right. And it's also, in a sense, a kind of shorthand.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like if we look at Anne Sexton's Cinderella, well, we know, you know, for the most part, the fairy tale Cinderella. So if we mm-hmm. put our own experiences as a layer on top of that and use Cinderella as a vehicle, right, then part of the work has already been done for us, and we're just adding layers, right. You know.
I mean, hopefully it'll spark the curiosity in someone to go back and look at the original.
Oh, definitely.
Because I know that always, when that, I love stumbling across a story somewhere and realizing, oh, this is a retelling of X, uh-huh. and I've not read that before, but I know it, you know, cultural literacy, whatever, and I can go back and I can check it out.
Right.
Well, that's what I did with the one that's out right now. I retold the Jason and the Argonauts myth.
Oh, awesome.
Laying it over my grandfather's biography. He was a road kid during the Depression.
Uh-huh.
And wandered around in California and Montana and basically all around the country, and ended up by the end of his life having this ability to spot almost to the county where someone was from in a particular state by their dialect.
Wow, that's amazing.
You know, never went to college, but he knew how he had been around and had an ear for dialects. You know, amazing stuff.
That is. Now I feel guilty that I haven't read your novel.
That's right. It's out there, you know. Who knows? Where was I going to go with what we were talking about? Oh, we're still tracking down other writers. Have you read any of, I think his name is Brian Turner? Any of his works?
Yeah, I actually know Brian.
Oh, you do?
Not really well, but yeah. Like when we run into each other at AWP or whatever, yeah, we talk. Yeah, Hear Bullet is amazing.
Yeah, that blew my doors off. I was amazed by that one.
Yeah, and, you know, we actually have it, you know, in the college library on reserve, just, you know, for our student veterans, because it's so therapeutic to know that you're not alone and the only person who's had that experience. I haven't read his works since then. I need to, you know, to look them up, but Hear Bullet is just an amazing collection. Yep.
I have his second one on the shelf and I've read parts of it. I read poetry very weirdly. You know, it's not like a novel, so I don't read it from front to back.
Right.
You know, unless I'm on a mission. And
that's
but most of the time
a normal way. I'm the weird person that starts at the beginning and ends all the way through.
Do you happen to know Ed Skoog?
I know his work. I've never met him, but yeah.
That's he and I were at K-State together as undergrads.
Oh, wow.
You know, which was, I like kind of keeping track of what's happening to my fellow writers when I went through. Do you do the same thing? I mean, do you keep track of your classmates who have gone on to do interesting things?
Kind of. I mean, Vermont's a little different just because it's low residency. So, you know, you spend 10 days in the summer together and then 10 days in the winter. But my roommate for a bunch of my residencies, Frances Badgett, is the fiction editor at Contrary, and I'm the poetry editor. So we sort of like, you know, run a magazine together. Jeff McMahon, who went to University of Chicago, where I went. So that's kind of the bridge, you know.
Mm-hmm. So with the magazine that you have to run the name of it by me again.
Contrary,
that's what I thought. So you guys are kind of decentralized. There's not an office for it since you're all spread out.
Yeah, it's pretty much all online. Like there was a point in time where, you know, Jeff's still in Chicago and we had an office, I guess, just where our mail came or something in the Wrigley building. But yeah, everything's online now. And it works, you know, we just each have our email addresses and we, you know, log in and go through our submissions and do everything through Facebook and email.
Cool.
Yeah.
What are you working on right now?
Well, right now it's more like this is the time of year where today's the last day of classes at the college and then next week's finals week. So right now it's just survival and grading papers. But I have, you know, poems that I want to be working on and, you know, just things sort of percolating in there. I hope percolating works as like a brain word.
Yes, it does. Absolutely does. I don't know how else to explain the things that happen in my brain to get stuff onto the page. I was having a conversation with someone today because I'd made some comment about being stuck in this one scene for like the last week, I think.
Right.
I had a really good productive run last Saturday and then just kind of fizzled.
Right.
And this person who said, well, you know, what always works is, you know, just go off and, you know, do something else, play Tetris, whatever, and let the brain work on it. And I was like, I could see how that works for some people, but that's not the way I work. I mean, I've been at this long enough that I know that I don't have a solid answer for everything.
Right.
But if I walk away from it, I tend to like not go back to things.
Okay.
For a really long time.
Right.
There's I don't know how many failed projects I have. but I guess it's not fair to say they're failed because they did something. They got some of those, you know, million bad words you have to get out of your system.
Right, yeah.
Out of my system. But what I've found is working a lot for me right now is the reason I'm stuck is because I've done something previously that has painted me into a corner. So I've got to work my way back up.
Right.
And rejigger each sentence back there until I've got the character psychologically ready to make the leap that I want them to make.
Right.
And then I can break out of that scene. So yeah, I've been playing the Xbox too much this week. So how did you end up in Oregon?
Well, I was in Florida, and I wasn't a Florida.
How did you end up in Florida?
I ended up in Florida. My first tenure track position was in Florida. So you know how, like, you get out of graduate school, you apply for, like, every job in the universe.
Right.
And I ended up in Florida. And I ended up there for the hurricane season that had more hurricanes than every other season since 1888.
Wow.
So, like, the season of, like, Francis, Ivan, then we thought Katrina might hit, like, that season.
Wow.
Yeah, and I wasn't, like, a heat and humidity person anyway.
Right.
So I just thought, oh, this is bad. So I didn't really draw a line across the country, but I joke that I just applied for every job north of Indianapolis, which is probably true. Mm-hmm. And so I was a finalist at a school in rural western Massachusetts, Colorado mm-hmm. Mountain College, and then here.
Oh, Colorado Mountain College.
Yeah, Colorado would have been amazing. But basically they said, if you can't afford to live in Florida, you probably can't afford to live here. Because it was, you know, like the housing bubble in Florida.
Right, right.
You know, one day I came home to my apartment and there was a notice on the door that said, once your lease is up, this is a condo and you can either buy it for $180,000 as is.
Wow.
Yeah, or $230,000 with renovations. And yeah, that just, so I thought, I'll be the only homeless person I know with two graduate degrees. So I started applying for jobs and been here since 2006.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is Florida as bonkers as I think it is from the news media?
Yes. Yes, it is. Actually, I don't know if I should give her secret away, but Terry Ann Thaxton is working on a poem called Florida Man, where she it's, you know, based on news stories as if they're a man. Because, I mean, you know those news stories, right? Like, Florida Man finds alligator in living room, or, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Florida Man eats the face off of a homeless man, right?
And, I mean, exactly. Yeah. It's a crazy place.
If I there are two places in this country that I absolutely three
uh-huh.
places in this country that I absolutely refuse to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Texas.
Okay. Even Austin? Like, what if you had a chance to go to, like, Austin City Limits?
If you could teleport me through, you know, from wherever I am now to Austin directly without having to travel through any other part of Texas, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. Other than that, Oklahoma.
Okay.
I'm done going to Oklahoma, even though I have family there. And the other one, and I think the only way I would go to Florida mm-hmm. is if I could be in some kind of protective, observing bubble science fiction thing, because I have a feeling that if I went to Florida, it would be like getting an STD. I'd be infected with something. It's just, it's so, I'm frightened and oddly fascinated by Florida because it just seems so batshit crazy down there.
Yeah, I mean, I lived there for 2 years, so yeah.
What was the strangest thing that happened to you in Florida?
Well, I think the bad thing, like what I just couldn't deal with, was the weather. Like, mm-hmm. I couldn't deal with feeling like I had heat exhaustion, like in February. but the weird thing was everything seemed so fake because Disney, you know, like,
right.
Like if your students can make a living dressing up as Goofy, then why are they going to come to college classes? I don't remember who this student is anymore, so hopefully this won't get back that I've told the story. Her parents met when they were both character actors at Disney. Like,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And what they did was, like, have sex in the weirdest costumes they could. So they,
oh, my God!
So, like, Cruella De Vil and Goofy, for instance, or, you know what I mean?
This, you know, there's actually, oh my God, there's, you know that there is a community somewhere online that's like the furries, but with Disney characters. We,
right, but, and then, you know, this was not like a rare thing. I mean, like that part right. was, but another student wrote a paper about, you know, her sister's teenage pregnancy. And it was mm-hmm. totally one of those where her sister was working at Disney and started sleeping with the guy who played, you know, like, go or, and it was just too weird. It was just very much too weird to live.
That is so surreal.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, I just want to live my life where I sit on the porch with my dog and drink a beer and write a poem. And
right.
Yeah. And it, I was living in this weird, you know, hurricanes hitting us all the time, Disney. It was just too much.
Now, did you meet your partner in Oregon or in Florida?
Actually, he is my high school boyfriend from Indiana.
Really?
Yeah. And we went separate ways and then found each other on Facebook. And
oh, cool.
Yeah. So I actually took him to homecoming my junior year.
That's amazing. I love stories like that. I'm a hopeless romantic, but those are cool.
Oh, well, thank you. It's kind of weird, but yeah. I think it's less rare now. Like, lots of people seem to have the whole Facebook, you know, mm-hmm. thing back with their prom date kind of.
So how did you guys reconnect after going your separate ways?
It was just, I mean, kind of weird. Like, we just started talking on Facebook and thought we should try this whole dating thing again. And yeah, I mean, it was cool. Very bizarre, but it worked. So
where were you guys in when it started? I mean, irrespectively.
She was in North Carolina and I was here in Oregon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That is a long distance relationship.
Right, yeah.
That's cool. How long have you guys been married now?
Well, we're not married, but I mean, we're together. Let's see, like 5 years we've been together.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
There's a story in that. Of course, you know, that's me going against pretty much every rant about bad writing advice I've ever given in my life, which is, you know, I hate the thing, write what you know.
Right.
Because people tend to take it literally.
Oh, yeah. You know?
And if I were to write what I knew, it'd just be, you know.
Office
stuff by a kid in Kansas, and it would just be boring. Oh, I follow who was it? French writer. I can't remember his name. He says be regular and orderly in your life so that you may be wild and creative in your work. Who was it that said that?
Right, I know that quote, but I'm not sure who it was.
Yeah. Oh, I'm incredibly regular in my real life. It's kind of sad, actually. I have some friends right now that are vacationing in Crete. They just got out of, you know, finished high school, and it's like, yay, good for you.
Right.
I haven't, I have. Oh, God, I have been out of Kansas in the last 10 years. At least twice.
Further than Oklahoma, or?
Yes. Twice to New York, once to Minneapolis and Colorado. So, yeah. Yes. My sister lives in Jersey City, so I've made a couple of trips out there to see her. Wow. Okay. We're getting close here. I usually go about an hour, but there's some other things. One of the things that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and this goes back to some of the problems that I had teaching Comp 1 and high school students and stuff like that, and some of the things we had talked about before. It's kind of the question I like to ask everybody who shows up. We're always, every year, you know, they come out with the new studies. They're, you know, the National Endowment for the Arts wringing their hands over the decline of literary reading and right. and all this other stuff. And then, of course, my experience with students and things like that. And it seems to me that as writers, we should be very concerned with the ecology of our literary environment, just like we're concerned about, renewable energy and recycling and all this other stuff like that. So we see this decline in literary reading of poetry, of literary novels and things like that. And I often come across writers that seem content to just let that decline and, you know, and sit around in their ivory academic tower and just write for other writers and writing programs. And the lineage that I attached myself to was the Beat Generation, Ann Waldman, Allen Ginsberg, and people that got out and thought that you should combine the personal, the artistic, and the political in right. what you're doing and get engaged and be mindful of the society that you're in. And then some people say, well, I really don't think the literary landscape is dwindling that much. And I'm thinking to myself, well, maybe it doesn't seem so from where you're at. But, you know, Amazon seems to be wanting to take over the literary world, and that would be a nightmare.
Right.
So what should... And I think that high school English classes are... Some of them are better than others. It depends on student stuff. If they end up in an advanced placement type of course, they might get more freedom to read and discuss openly in literature. But my experience in high school English, and I've had mm-hmm. other people, you know, confirm it. Well, their experience was that when you're in the average English class, not remedial, not advanced, the teacher's got almost 30 students just trying to push right. them through. And so the conversations about stories are about some of the less adept stories by mm-hmm. good writers. And the teacher's driving them to one interpretation right. of the story. And that tends to lead students to think that they're, if they don't agree with that interpretation, to think that they're stupid, that they don't get it, you know, their opinions and ideas don't work, and so right. they give up on reading. They don't think they're smart enough to get it. It's frustrating, you know, as a writer for me, because, you know, I don't have a career if there aren't people reading and buying right. books. So what do you think we as writers can do to, you know, resuscitate, to champion writers, not just to our own work, but to literature in general? How should we get engaged?
Right. I mean, I think that it's a huge question, and there's so much that needs to be done. Like, I think writers in the schools programs would be great, but not just, you know, like if you can get funding and, you know, and I know it's hard to want to work for free, but not every school can pay a writer, you know? So, I mean, you know, right. visit the schools in your neighborhood maybe and give a workshop, give a reading, the local public libraries. I think also we have to make reading fun again, instead of what you said, the sort of like just reading for comprehension or the interpretation that the teacher wants. Something that I'm sort of nerdily excited about, and I think a lot of people are, is LeVar Burton trying to bring back Reading Rainbow. Yeah, yes. So I think even just for like little kids, you know, making reading fun and interesting again. And I also think students seeing work by authors that they identify with and with characters that they identify with. Like one of my friends, well, actually a Facebook friend, Alice Anderson, I'm guessing you're probably Facebook friends with her. She has many writer friends, but her daughter got...
If not, we will be soon.
Her daughter got her summer reading list for high school, and it was 90% male authors. Yes.
What?
But I mean, looking at high schools, like, that's maybe not that surprising. So, I mean, what happens if you're, you know, the female or, you know, the Asian kid or the African-American kid, and you get this white right. male reading list? You know, how are you going to see yourself as contributing, you know, if you think that's the community? Right. So I think really pushing for diversity. And mm-hmm. we have seen some literature really excite kids, you know, like Harry Potter, The Hunger Games, maybe right, being right. less snobby about that sort of stuff. And I'll admit I'm snobby. Yeah. Like, I'm very snobby about Twilight. I've never been to Twilight, but...
I understand the Twilight thing because that's it seems that always seemed to me so horribly sexist.
My master's thesis was on Dracula, so maybe I'm just very snobby about I want vampires to be a certain
vampire.
but I guess if kids are going to camp out waiting for a book to come out, we should support that, mm-hmm. you know, whether or not we like that author or that book or, you know, the community in Idaho that banned Sherman Alexie's Absolutely True Diary. And then that girl got like 350 copies or something and was like giving them away at the park. Like, that teenager, whoever she is, should be a national hero. I mean, we yes. need to support, you oh, know, wow. that kind of thing.
Yeah. I'm very much in favor of forcing the publishing industry to wrestle with cross-genre works because they are so obsessed right now with classifying stuff for right. marketing purposes. Have you heard about the new adult category?
I haven't.
It's supposed to be this thing that now sits in between young adult and then oh, grown-up wow. fiction for kids that are like in college and just okay. out of college. And it's like, really? You haven't grown up enough that you need to be stepped into adulthood through another right. step? Oh, my God. You know, when I was 16, I was trying to read the Satanic Verses. I mean...
Right.
I was never interested in reading about people my uh-huh. own age. You know, and whatever.
Right, yeah. I think if I ever read anything that was young adult, and of course, you know, I'm 37, so I think that, well, you know what I mean? Like, young adult stuff back then was different. So it was very much you know, kind of like teen movie, you know, where if the girl got rid of her glasses and wore contacts, then she could be the prom queen, you know? So I think I read right. those sort of things. But they didn't, you know, yeah. like maybe for one summer or something. And then I was on to like regular adult literature.
Yeah. No, when I was growing up, you know, you kind of went from things like, what was it? You know, the Amelia Bedelia books and Encyclopedia Brown and you know, that obvious right. kid stuff. You know, maybe like the Bridge to Terabithia and stuff like that. You went straight from that mm-hmm. to... Hemingway and Faulkner.
Right, and that's what I mean. Like I went from that to, like, maybe, you know, like, the teen girl wish fulfillment, how can I date a quarterback? You know, like, I had a summer of that to the books that you're talking right. about.
Oh.
So, I don't understand.
Seems to me that there should, that there's a, there's a certain literary rite of passage that we are that the publishing industry, through making all of these age appropriate genres, is erasing from the literary landscape.
They're also doing it with gender. I mean, you know, let's put like pink flowers in a purse on this book, and that will get women to read it. I mean, that will like repel me from it. Like,
it'll definitely repel boys from it. That's
but,
for sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird branding going on in publishing.
Yeah. There needs to be that transgressive leap that you hide from your parents in literature. I mean, there has to be that transition. I mean, that type of transition, because it's a way of establishing autonomy.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's how you become an individual is.
And now we're not, because it's all you're all now getting age appropriate, establishment approved books. Oh, I know this will be okay for me, and I'm 20. You should be reading whatever the.
Right. No, like I remember being, I mean, I don't know, fourth, fifth grade, and reading Piers Anthony and being like, ooh, there's a sex scene here. What is going on? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that might help. I mean, I'm very interested right now in the writers that are starting to smash genre together. Neil Gaiman, Michael Chabon.
I was going to say, even Benjamin Percy, Red Moon, you know, the werewolf.
What's her name? Visit from the Goon Squad.
Elizabeth Egan.
Egan, yeah. I've know who she is. I've flipped through the books. I haven't. There's something that's keeping me from picking them up, but I think it's just the
the purse on the cover. No, I'm kidding. There's not a purse on the cover.
There's not another person. I think maybe it's just the hype that's comes. You know, she was kind of anointed by the New York media, and it's like.
But
really?
it does. Will help you be less afraid to have quirky, crazy characters and to have quirky, crazy things happen.
Oh, I wish I could remember this. I have the book on my shelf and I don't want to get up and go get it. Woman wrote this book, and the basic premise of it is that the rotation of the earth is slowing down. I think it's called The Age of Miracles is the name of the book. And so there's these weird physics go on throughout the story as the rotation stops. You know, people are able to float and all this other weird stuff. It's on my list to do thing. I've heard her read from a section of it when she visited here, but it's one of those kind of weird science fiction-y genre mashup things. And when you do that, we can maybe get people out of their cliquish things and whatever you can get. And those people who have had their native intelligence stomped down, you can pull them out of the, that pit of emptiness, you know, and get them a book in their hands. And maybe we can diminish the obsession with people like Dan Brown. Because, he insults his reader's intelligence.
Right.
You know, like... It's so horrible. So horrible. Are you a fan of literary feuds?
Not especially. I mean, I wouldn't say that I really know enough to... The literary world is so small that you just... Everyone should play nice, you know?
I understand. I'm kind of... I'm a fan of the literary feud for the right reason. I mean, personal animus, that's kind of petty. But I think if there's a writer out there who is obviously doing something that I find harmful, say the people who are still writing or trying to push in fiction Ayn Rand's philosophy.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, those people should be argued with and smacked down in public as much as possible.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. But the sort of catty, like, you know,
Yep.
My book was going to be made into a movie, and then it got dropped, and your book got picked up. Like, I'm not into that, you know.
Right. Yeah, you should be happy for your friends, even sometimes your enemies, right. Depending. You know, that's there's always, it helps us all to a certain extent.
Yes, definitely.
We had talked about this, or you'd mentioned it before. So to send us out, is there a particular poem you would like to share with us, or should I pick one?
You could pick one if you want. That would be sort of exciting.
Okay, because there are a couple that I'm... Let's go with, because I think it feels a okay. little topical.
Let me see, what page is that on? Oh, okay, page perfect.
I've got it right here.
Okay, there are men. There are men who are at once scalpel and salve. They have only one spigot for honey or gasoline, and you don't know which you will get until it hits your tongue. Sip slowly. Protect the soft palate. They will whittle you until you become the loneliest statue on the planet. Some days this will make you feel special and singular. Your pedestal will be dizzying. When you and the other muses lean toward one another, some of you will shatter. This is to be expected. This was always the plan. There will be more of you. There always are. Always have been.
There's something very stark in that poem. Very dangerous, I think.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about it a lot, you know, and I'm not quite sure how to articulate it. That's one of the things I love about poetry, is that it doesn't, when it's done well, it I don't often find a way to articulate.
Right.
Because it's hit that bell in the subconscious, and you know that's the necessity of poetry, is that there's that emotional resonance and knowledge that you have within your head, and if a poet's done it well, then that poem right there are the words for it.
Thank you. It.
So I enjoyed your work. Everybody should go out and get it. Who's listening? The Children's War is the new one.
A Brief History of Time.
A Brief History of Time, which I will have to get my hands on. I haven't read that one yet.
Just PM me your address and I'll keep it.
Now I will throw money at your publisher and at you. That's the best way to do it.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that's appreciated. Here I was going to, you know, like give it away for free.
Oh, no. I spent too many years working as an independent bookseller. I know how the business works. You know, I have a friend I've known since the third grade who was like, I want a signed copy. I said, well, go buy one and I'll sign it for you. And I haven't heard from him since. don't go away, but I will close out here. Thank you, Shandell, for taking the time to talk with me. And we will, cool.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. All right, so there you have it, my conversation with Shandell Beers. Be back in 2 weeks. I'm not sure who I'm going to have on next. It could be one of three people. I'm still working those angles and those connections, so we'll see. Episode 19 will, I guess, be a surprise. See you in 2 weeks.